still got spiders coming down. Where's Paul gone? Thank you, Paul. Anyway, where did he go with the tattoos? Thank you. And thank you very much. And thank you all for coming after that amazing. Who was at the service? Amazing. Absolutely fantastic. And it's great to be here at Greenbelt and good to be looking today at Christian-Muslim relations and how we go beyond the niceties. And as you know, and as I know, up and down the country, there's loads and loads of good Christian-Muslim stuff going on. And as I look around, I think there are a few people, spotted Ashley in the front here, but there are others who are sort of intensely involved in this work. So after I've said a few words, I hope there'll be time for the mic to go round and we can hear from everybody who has something to share your thoughts or your reflections on this topic. So I'm still getting a bit... still got the spider... It's tickling me. Yeah. No, it likes me. So today we're looking beyond the niceties. We're looking beyond the formal visits, which I'm sure many of us have done, to the local Islamic centre, if we're lucky to have one down the road, or meeting up at the town hall to talk about the things that local authorities talk about, parking at funerals, or resilience planning, or working together on social action projects. Christian-Muslim Forum is doing quite a lot on refugees at the moment. The sorts of things that bring us together, Christians and Muslims together. And looking beyond classic interfaith dialogue, beyond attending. How many people have attended an iftar meal where the... Yeah, quite a few. I mean, it's growing and growing. So, and it's wonderful when mosques open their doors and we can be guests there. So beyond that sort of a thing, all these things are very precious and valuable, as we know, and it allows us to get to know each other and to develop understanding and friendship. And those meetings, those friendships, can also lead on to these other conversations beyond the niceties. So we're looking at the tricky areas, and I'm sure you've probably all got a list in your back pocket of your own particular tricky areas with Christian-Muslim relations. So the topics that we hesitate to broach with our Muslim friends and colleagues, the things that we draw back on, what do we do about that kind of thing? And we wonder, am I going to look clumsy? Do I know enough to be able to step into this? What am I getting into? What will they think? I'd like to dig deeper into this, but how do I start? And especially nowadays, what do we do when things kick off overseas? Or closer to home when there's something really horrible in the news. So how do we navigate the complex stuff while retaining the good relations that we have with Muslim friends and colleagues and people down the road? Or could it be the case that getting into these tricky areas, going beyond the niceties, can actually deepen our friendship and understanding? But a couple of things before we get into that. First off, as you know, there are some things that Christians and Muslims will never, ever, ever agree on. We are in fact, different. So if my Muslim friends suddenly accepted the doctrine of the Trinity, they would be well on their way to becoming Christian. And if I accepted the Muslim view of Jesus, I'd be on my way to embracing Islam. So good Christian-Muslim relations must be based on something beyond having things in common. Because we're not the same, and sooner or later we'll reach a point where this becomes evident, our commonality becomes evident, and there are things beyond that. And if our relationship is just based on that commonality, that's it. We're limited just to that space. But we would like our relationships to be bigger than that. So there's sometimes a bit of theological work we need to do ourselves on this as to why we're doing it in the first place. And it goes without saying that we must be free to share our faith. Some of my Muslim friends want to share the riches of their faith with me, just as I want them to know the beauty, the liberation and transformative power of Christianity. There are good and there are not so good occasions for this to happen. And the Christian-Muslim Forum has guidelines on this. but it is one of the great freedoms we have in this country and can also, maybe surprisingly, and maybe some of you have discovered this for yourselves, it can actually deepen understanding and friendship when it occurs. So today will be a game of two halves. There are things about Islam and Muslims that Christians worry about, that I worry about, and maybe things that you're worrying about. But there are also things about Christianity and Christians that Muslims worry about. So we'll look at one or two of those as well. Just a quick backdrop to Christian-Muslim relations. The Christian-Muslim Forum has been going for about 10 years, a little bit longer if you count all the preliminary talkings that led to the formation of the forum. And I think, looking around, there'll be people in this room who've probably been doing this kind of thing for longer than that, 10, 15, 20 longer years. And I don't know about you, but in my opinion, things have changed and they haven't changed for the better. I look back even to the time just after 7/7 and the London bombs and read some of the things I wrote back then. For instance, Muslim colleagues saying that they were getting disapproving glances as if the 7/7 bombings were somehow their fault. And that's pretty tame compared to some of the stuff that's flying around now. That's pretty tame. And I look back to those days only 11 years ago, like a more innocent era. And Archbishop Justin, who's our founding patron at the forum, has said that Muslims are under pressure. And I doubt many of us would disagree with that. It's hard to be a Muslim in Britain today. So Christian-Muslim relations are not just about difference or about different beliefs. They're also about power and power differentials. If I'm sitting around a table, if you're sitting around a table with a diverse bunch of Christians and Muslims, for me, I'll be a white middle-class woman, white middle-class female Christian. But my experience of being a Christian will be very different from my black male working-class Christian colleague. And the Asian headscarf-wearing Muslim woman will have a very different experience of being Muslim from the white jeans and t-shirt-wearing man who embraced Islam comparatively recently. So ethnicity, class, gender all play their part if we simply view Christian-Muslim relations through a religious lens alone and look only at belief, we're missing much of what is significant. And there are some stark asymmetries between the two populations in Britain today. Many more Christians, as we know, but roughly 60% from the last census, ticked the Christian box. Muslims, roughly 5%, so lots more Christians than there are Muslims. Muslim population is much younger, about half are under 25 years old, and with Christians, that's only a quarter under 25. And Christians are far less likely to be from an ethnic minority, only 7%, whereas Muslims, 89% are from an ethnic minority group. And related to this, of course, Britain has a whole colonial heritage, which gives people in this country lots of different histories, languages, cuisines, and perspectives. I don't know if anybody reads Gary Young. I think he used to write for The Guardian. Anybody read Gary Young, journalist? Black guy with roots in the Caribbean, but born and bred in Britain. And if he's asked by white British people, why are you here? His answer is, because you were there. So we have that relationship with our... Is it the spiders? But I think that's a good one. Why are you here? Because you were there. So that's history, and that gives us lots of opportunities, but it does mean we've got lots of different kinds of people, lots of different kinds of Muslims, lots of different kinds of Christians in this country. Christian churches and institutions have been going on a whole lot longer than Muslim ones. So you think of our cathedrals, hundreds of years. And Muslim places of worship and organisations don't have that longevity. They don't have the property, the organisational history, or clout at local or national level that Christians do. And I just wonder, any Desert Island Discs listeners? One or two? No, quite a lot. My husband's a big fan of Desert Island Discs. Did anybody listen to Nadia Hussein the other day? Anybody? Yeah. And I think some of the stuff hit the headlines of what she was saying. So I did it on Catch Up, and I got the quote. Nadia Hussein, the British Bake Off winner, young Muslim woman, she said, "I expect to be shoved or pushed or verbally abused because it happens. It's happened for years," she said. And probably you'll be the same as me with some of your hijab-wearing friends will be just a little bit more reluctant to go out, especially after dark, or to be travelling alone than they were a few years ago. And hate crime for Muslims and for Jews has just kept rising. It spikes, but it doesn't actually go down to the levels it was a few years ago. So hate crime for Muslims is an issue that is just not for Christians. And again, that mix of race and religion and gender play a part in this. And even unemployment, much higher for Muslims, especially the young men, 76% less likely to get a job than their Christian counterparts. Muslim women, 65% less likely. And CVs, tried to get the figures on this, but anecdotally, certainly CVs with Muslim names on, you have to submit an awful lot more of those to get an interview than if you have a non-Muslim name. And even Brexit. Anybody know how the percentage of Christians that voted to leave? 58%. And the majority of Muslims, 70%, voted to remain. So there are differences between our two communities, even though each one is very, very varied. I think one of the most important ones is access to decision makers. I'm sure Downing Street would accept the Archbishop's call if he made it, even if Theresa May doesn't have him on speed dial quite yet. The historic churches especially are very well networked in the corridors of power. And the Church of England, as you know, has bishops in the House of Lords, and they play a part in our legislature. There are some Muslims in high office, but nothing like the access that Christians and churches have. And of course, media coverage, the mainstream media in general, is a lot more negative towards Muslims and Islam than it is towards religion in general. And I think we're probably all quite well aware of that. So I chose three hot topics for Christians. They may or may not be yours, but you'll have your turn a little bit later to talk about your hot topic. And the first one is women and women in Islam. And actually, it was mentioned in the in one of the songs just this morning, the burkini. So who's been following that story? it's been hard if you've been in the country not to come across the bikini story. And it seems to be a sort of a competition against two lots of freedoms. There's some people saying if we don't allow people to wear the burkini, women to wear burkini, then that will liberate them. They will no longer be oppressed by their husbands and their religion and their family. And others saying, no, we don't want the state or the police or anybody else telling people what to wear. It's freedom if they can just wear whatever they like. And religious cultural wars often revolve around what women wear and what women look like. And this applies to those wearing the headscarf and niqab, as well as to receptionists wearing high heels. Do you remember that coming up? And what women in business, especially at the outward-facing end, have to look like. So what women look like is often more important than what they say or what they do. But this story also had another couple of threads running through it, I thought. I was listening to phone in on Friday. I think it was radio. Is Jeremy Vine on Radio 2? Is he? Yeah. So I think it was him. And so it was quite a well-balanced programme, I thought, overall. And people were phoning in saying, yes, let them wear what they like, or no, we must... it's not a good thing that women are wearing burkinis on the beach. But when somebody phoned in to say women should be able to make their own choice and wear what they like, Jeremy Vine came back almost always and said something like, well, the French have had a really difficult time of it lately. Nice, the murder of Father Hamal, the Stade de France attacks, and of course Charlie Hebdo. And this seemed to imply that there was some link between the atrocities that killed hundreds of people and ordinary Muslim women relaxing on the beach. And I think we had it recently again with Kelvin McKenzie. Remember the Channel 4 reporter who, I think she, was it just after the Nice attack? And there was a Channel 4 anchor journalist wearing hijab. And I think it was Kelvin McKenzie who wrote and said, that it was insensitive and that they should have swapped around the rota so that it wasn't somebody who looked Muslim who was reporting on this terrible thing. And so it's as if any Muslim was at least partially responsible for the attack and should therefore keep out of public view, and that to flaunt her Muslimness was somehow shameless when she should have felt responsibility, at least some responsibility and some shame for what had happened. And the burkini story is a bit similar. If we see a burkini on the beach, it reminds us of the Nice attack, and that kind of conflates extremism with simply being Muslim. So we need to ask ourselves, is this the case? Are all Muslims responsible, partially responsible, more than we are, as Christians, responsible for these dreadful atrocities? Or are they as devastated as the rest of us when these attacks take place? And that's something we need to ask ourselves, talk to people about, and make up our own mind about. The last thread I thought was on race. Muslim women in France are much more likely to be North African or black, maybe Asian, and therefore less likely to be wanting to acquire a tan on the beach. And this is another factor that disrupts that beach scene, which in part is a place to display your beach. What was it called? There was a beach-ready body. Did you anybody hear about how you get your beach-ready body? If you're a woman, not if you're a man, obviously. If you're a woman, get your body beach-ready for the summer. And somehow these women who are not even trying to get a tan and covered in a burkini, they're not kind of really playing the game. So I think it's a really interesting story that had quite a few elements to it. But the main one was about, are women, are we liberating women or are we oppressing them, Muslim women, by allowing them or allowing them to wear the burkini or insisting that they take clothes off on the beach? So with gender justice, there are lots of other things that come up under this heading: women being confined to the home, domestic violence, forced marriage, the treatment that women get in Sharia courts. What Islam says and what Muslims practice are not always the same thing, just as we know that what Christianity says and what we practice doesn't always quite add up. And there are many, many Muslim women and men working to uphold women's rights and campaigning against domestic violence, forced marriage, discrimination. And so if we are concerned about how women are treated, we can join forces with those Muslim activists to promote change. And we have some experience of that within the churches. And lastly, on women, mosques. I'm in and out of mosques quite a lot. Is that part of anybody else's life here, especially the women here? Do you visit mosques? You do? One or two. And sometimes I get a bit cross, I don't know if you do, if the women's bit is sort of down the side and through a puddle and up a step and into a room with no windows and all that kind of stuff. So I get a bit fed up with that as well. So mosques are male-dominated with little access for women. There are online and real-life campaigns by Muslim women and men to improve things. And again, we can support those who are working for change. We need to remember that, as I said earlier, Muslim institutions are still finding their feet. They're not quite as out there and confident as our Christian organisations and places of worship. So it's not necessarily Islam that's determining what's happening at these mosques. Rather, it's the Muslims who are running them. And there's a bit of a difference there. And as we're doing so, we might remember the long struggle for gender equality in the church and the very recent enthroning of women as bishops in the Church of England. And I also always remember that Switzerland, what date was it that Switzerland gave women the vote? 1991, was it as late as that? What's in the 70s? It's definitely in my lifetime. So it's not just in the religious world, right across the board, patriarchy is a thing, as they say. I've got my son, his girlfriend down here, so patriarchy is a thing. So we can check out Muslim feminism and see what they think, and see what we think about what they think. We can get to know a few hijabis, people who wear the veil, even the whole thing, ask them why they cover themselves, and see what we can make of their answers. We can Google She Speaks, We Hear. It's one I recommend. Women's Voice. I'll give you the links afterwards if you'd like to check them out. And the Christian Muslim Forum, we have a group of young Muslim and Christian women working specifically on gender equality. If you're interested, let me know. Second one I thought we should look at is grooming and child sexual exploitation by Muslim gangs. And the notorious cases have been in Rotherham and Rochdale. Anybody from Rotherham and Rochdale or Rochdale? Rochdale. And I'm sure there are people in the room who will know a lot more. You certainly know more about these cases than I do. Julie Siddiqui, who's also at Greenbelt this year, and the Bishop Leeds launched Communities Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation, so joining together to condemn and prevent it. But we can also ask, I think, whether it's religion or class or occupation, other than criminality, that's the major determining factor here. Minicab drivers and fast food outlets, and I don't know whether you would agree or not, but those involved in the nighttime economy were in the right place and the right time to perpetrate these crimes and cause such dreadful long-term suffering. So they were Muslim men, there was no doubt about that, but were there other factors? Was being Muslim the driving factor, or was it a mix of things? And of course, the far-right groups have capitalised on this and are widening the divisions, particularly in Rotherham. I don't know if they are in Rochdale as well. They're trying. So is this okay? Is this okay for us as Christians, churches, Christian organisations? Or is there something that we as church people can do about that widening of divisions and increase in tensions? And of course, child exploitation isn't restricted to Muslims. The BBC, the NHS, Children's Homes, Roman Catholic Church, Church of England, all fallen short of the mark on this. And again, we can find the Muslims who are active, join them, support them, work together on it. If we need to check out whether Islam condones this kind of thing, then we need to do that properly and find the right people to talk to. But we mustn't let people use it to divide communities more than they already are. So we need to get the facts and campaign together. The third is extremism, and there are no, unless there's anybody here who's got an easy answer to extremism, I don't think there are any easy answers. Would have found an easy answer if there was one. And I was talking to someone yesterday and she said, well, of course, ISIS changed everything. That may be true, maybe not, but certainly it's a great deal of concern, and there's been a high level of security since 9/11, and then the London bombs, the murder of Lee Rigby, the rise of ISIS, foreign fighters going out, and the atrocities carried out in Syria and Iraq, and ISIS-inspired attacks in Europe. And the vast majority of the victims of terrorism, as we know, are Muslim, and we see this regularly on our TV screens, particularly in Iraq and Turkey. And a common complaint I hear a lot is that why don't they condemn it more? Why don't Muslims condemn these dreadful atrocities? And from where I am, I see that they do, that there are no end of statements and condemning of these horrible things and press releases and so on. But that it's not often picked up by the mass media. And so it's not amplified so that people... Has it slipped again? Is it spiders?
Yeah, it's the spiders.
And with social media can default to bubbles of interest. So sometimes those messages don't get out either. So perhaps there's something that we can do to say to people who, like the ones who say to me, but they don't really, you know, they're not really bothered about this, these Muslims, they're not condemning it, just to point them to some of the websites and some of the events and some of those solidarities, saying, yes, they do, but what more can they do if the media doesn't pick it up? So the situation is complex, but there is little consensus, I think, at the moment on how to overcome the extremism, the terrorism that we're seeing. Northern Ireland is still not completely at peace for those who've been involved in that process. So I think we're looking at a long haul on this. but involving Muslim expertise in finding solutions seems to me to be one of the key factors which will assist, rather than keeping our Muslim friends and Muslim organisations at one remove. So turning it around, two hot topics for Muslims. Solidarity would be one of them, I think, I would say, listening to my Muslim friends, and particularly solidarity on the huge rise in hate crime against Muslims and Jews that I mentioned earlier. And also the media coverage of Muslims often being seen only through a security lens, with civil liberties and hate crime, as I say, often ignored. So some Muslims, particularly those who are active in challenging injustice and discrimination, are disappointed that the full weight of the church, what I was talking about earlier, about the voice that we have, just as a matter of history, that the weight of the church is not more vocal on this. So the church is committed to peace and justice, to loving our neighbour. So why aren't we active on this, is what I hear. The church campaigns very effectively, as we know, and Greenbelt's absolutely full of it, it's fantastic, on food poverty, debt. Archbishop's fantastic initiative on debt, homelessness, international development, and we have Racial Justice Sunday just around the corner in September. But there's not so much on hate crime and bigotry against minority religions. And that is felt, I think, by some of our Muslim friends. And there's now, anybody come across this flying by while Muslim syndrome, flying but while Muslim? Yeah? So not just the increased security checks if you look Muslim, but now you can be sitting waiting for takeoff and be texting something or reading something. I'm sure you've seen these reports in the newspaper, and somebody will kind of, not sure how they actually do see what's on your mobile phone, but they suspect there's something bit iffy about you. And so they can just get the attendance, and you're escorted from the plane, and security officers have a word with you, and if it doesn't take too long, you might be able to get back onto the plane. But these sort of drip sort of inconveniences, and being singled out, and being suspicious, it must be a hard thing to be living with day in, day out. And I think there was a programme on the Radio 4 the other day about the empty seat syndrome. So there's one empty seat on the bus or one empty seat on the train, and the other seat is occupied by somebody who looks Muslim. Other people get on, but they don't take that empty seat because they don't want to sit next to that person who looks Muslim. So I don't know what you think, but I think that is different from 10 years ago. Do you think that's different from 10 years ago? I just feel that is, we're in a different space now. And if I feel that, then my Muslim colleagues and friends are certainly feeling it a lot more. So I think we have to ask ourselves, is reconciliation one of our core tasks as Christians and as members of Christian communities, whether we belong to a church or more informal Christian community? Or do we leave that reconciliation bit to Coventry Cathedral, St. Ethelburga's for London people, to the Mennonites, if anybody's been on some of their courses? Do we leave that reconciliation bit to the specialists, or do we consider that that's core work for us as individual Christians and as Christian institutions? And how do we help reconcile ourselves to Muslim communities and to help the general public and Muslim communities to understand each other better, to reduce misperceptions, build trust and friendship? And second one would be hospitality. There were a few hands that went up who said they had gone along to eat at an iftar to break the fast. And Islamic centres regularly open their doors to visitors, in my experience, and invite Christian clergy and others to speak. But churches seem to be less likely to return the compliment. So how could we encourage a few more invitations the other way? And sometimes I think that Harvest Festival might be one, because we eat a Harvest Festival. But there may be other occasions where we could just invite our neighbours to celebrate with us, and to not for the purpose of them becoming Christians, but just to as neighbours and friends. The you'll see some of these booklets, I think they're down on the stage, of the Christian Muslim Forum's twinning program, Church Mosque twinning program, and that's something that helps those sorts of relationships to develop, two-way relationships. And sometimes as churches, we sometimes don't feel we have very much to offer to be a friend to the local Islamic center. And sometimes we think things are difficult enough as it is, running a church. We're hard-pressed to keep the show on the road anyway. But actually, that the friendship that an Islamic center and the leaders and the members of that Islamic center can benefit from getting to know church people, is really very valuable. That link into civil society, to be accepted by the establishment, to be acknowledged, especially in the situation that we have at the moment, not to be rejected or ostracized, and to have someone stand by you when you're talking about housing or local schools or buses or youth clubs or lack of youth clubs, food poverty, homeless, lots of things that both Islamic centers and churches are doing a lot of work on. It's very valuable. So to be civic leaders together is something that strengthens both and benefits the local community. So just a few questions before the mic goes over to you in conclusion. Can we make reconciliation one of our core tasks in church life? If there are divisions, let's not shy away from these difficult topics or conversations. It's not going to be the first thing you're going to jump into as soon as you meet somebody who's Muslim for the first time. But it can, pushing those boundaries and talking about some of these difficult things can enrich and deepen our relationships and lead to positive change. It can bring hope and peace. How can we find ways to humanize our relationships, to get to know and trust each other, to relate to Muslims in the round as complex human beings that they are, just as we are? And I think anybody involved in the Near Neighbours programme? It's patchy, it's a little postcode thing, Rochdale and others. Yeah, so really good source of just very, would you agree, quick and easy small grants just to get things going, and a wealth of experience. The Christian Muslim Forum is a national partner of the Near Neighbours programme, and it's a good one to be in touch with. If you belong to them, any Methodists here? I hope there's some Methodists. Any Methodists? Yes, Methodist Church. So the Christian Muslim Forum is working quite closely with the Methodist Church at the moment. So if you're Methodist, do see me afterwards, see if you'd like to become involved. But when we're worried about an aspect of Islam or what Muslims are reportedly doing or saying, are we able to find a Muslim friend, someone experienced in this area, or an expert in the field to talk it over rather than Googling and chancing to luck? The forum, again, can always help put you in touch with somebody if that's what you would like. And going further, how do we support the many Muslims who are active in changing things and in these very tricky issues that I've been talking about for the better? Those who are challenging misogyny and patriarchy, working to eliminate child sexual exploitation, and who are challenging extremism. And again, the forum can link you to those organisations and people if you would like to be linked. And are we using the structures that we have as churches and our combined public voice to stand in solidarity with Muslims when they're unfairly targeted or treated badly? I know a personal text message is always appreciated, and I'm sure many of you will do that. When something kicks off, you'll be sending a WhatsApp message to your Muslim friends to say, it's tough, I hope you're okay. Let me know if it's something I can do. But how about an article in the press, or a jointly written article in the press, or some joint action to show that the kind of treatment that they're receiving goes against our Christian values? And are we able to listen and understand how things are for our Muslim friends and interpret what they say back to our own communities, especially the ones who are really struggling with some of this? And then the other way around, can we find Muslim friends who will do the same, who will interpret our concerns, whatever they may be, interpret our concerns back to their communities? And so we get some bridge building. So I'd say this is an ongoing conversation. It's live. We must be able to talk about what we disagree on and what troubles us. The UK is one of the countries where we can do this in relative safety. There are conversations that can take place here which could never take place. I'm sure some of you have probably worked in these areas, in these places, in these cities, in Baghdad, Karachi, Cairo, let alone Syria. So let's make the most of this. And the Christian Muslim Forum is holding together a credible network of Muslims and Christians who don't always agree with each other. Sometimes wonder if they're ever going to agree about anything with each other. But anyway, they're chosen so that they are a very wide spectrum of Christians and Muslims. Don't always agree, but they do. They are committed to wanting to find solutions to problems. And when they do disagree, they're committed to disagreeing well. It's tough, very tough. Some of those conversations are very tough. But if you're up for it, please let me know. And I'll just finish by saying it's serious. Many Muslims are deeply worried about what's happening. Many Christians are deeply worried. So let's be serious and determined about it. Find out what we need to know, make the necessary connections, and do something practical and positive so we can build stronger Christian-Muslim relationships by grasping some of these nettles and going beyond the niceties. Thank you. Thank you. And I think Paul has got oh, there are two mics. So it would be great to hear what's going on in different parts of the country and your reflections and your thoughts. Gentleman with a white beard at the back.
More of a comment than a question. In the paper yesterday, there was a report that in Afghanistan, 40 years ago, you would rarely have seen a burqa or a headscarf. It's only been recently that those sorts of things have been almost sort of forced on women, and women have accepted it.
Yes, I think, well, some of that may be true. I don't know. How would we know if the women accepted it or not? I don't know. But certainly things have changed. But talk to British Muslim women and ask them, why do they wear a hijab? Why do they wear a headscarf? Why do they wear a niqab? And I find a whole variety of answers, some of them strongly feminist. Somebody there at the back, and then somebody down here.
We made friends with someone from MEND, which is Muslim Engagement and Development, and they have a 45-minute presentation on Islamophobia, causes and cures, and we invited them to present it to us in our church, and we did it with churches around and invited our local mosques to come and host it with us. That was a really good way of taking hate crime very seriously and allowing them to, I guess, meeting them on their terms and discovering how to love them better and take seriously, something they take very seriously. Muslim Engagement and Development.
Thank you. And I think I know MEND, but I don't think it's on our website, MEND, and it should be. And that's good. I didn't know they did that. And I think that's to make a comfortable space for people to be able to talk about difficult stuff, because we don't like to, you know, find it difficult to talk about difficult stuff when we're not comfortable. So Muslims are the same. So that sounds like a really good way to do that jointly, but to make sure it's sort of firmly... it's a secure place for them to speak, and so that we can really hear what's going on. And as you know, it's awful. Gentleman at the front.
Sorry, madam, I apologize for taking up your time. I've noticed something amongst the Muslims in terms of boy-girl relationship. It's a dangerous game. I've noticed that Muslims like Christians and vice versa, boy-girl relationship. I've noticed that. But on the other hand, a few of them Muslims are coming Christian, through the Christian testimony, if you know what I mean by that. I've noticed that. You can tell.
I'm not quite getting you what you mean by the boy-girl relationships and what's...
it's hard to explain. Friendship, boy-girl friendships. I've noticed...
Teenagers, young people.
Yeah, young Muslims, I've noticed that. Muslim girls,
Muslim girls are?
Some Christian, young Christians. I've noticed that. You can tell. It's hard to explain to words.
Did anybody else? I'm not getting that. I'm really sorry.
It's a comment.
As a comment. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry. Yes, I should be doing this.
I was surprised that the prevent agenda didn't come up in anything that you've said. And as an RE teacher, I have opinions about it, which I won't share. But I was wondering whether you would like to share your opinions and whether you feel that that's also something that needs quite a public Christian response to.
There is a review, I believe, of the prevent agenda underway, or shortly to underway. And there are various opinions within the Muslim communities about the prevent agenda. Some think, yes, it is preventing some stuff, and others think it's doing more harm than good, as you probably know. The prevent agenda is the government's program to prevent extremism and terrorism. And
so it seems like saying it as school teachers, we are then trained.
And
interesting images are used of the people that are illustrating the points that are being made. There's a lot of headscarves going on in the training that we've been thinking of. And yeah, and it's essentially so that we can kind of be up and I'm not being rules, be spies
So how many people here have had that training who are public? Okay. So you'd know very well what the length that the prevent program goes to try to protect us. You know, it comes from a good place, but and it is the government's duty to keep us safe, but it has had some quite down. Some downsides. I don't know, does anybody want the microphone to be able to say something? There's a couple.
Thank you. I'm a bit out of these visual
yes, sorry.
radar. I've got a really good friend who has been a dialogue officer at Blackburn Cathedral, and we've kind of had conversations. And something I thought might be a really good idea is I've actually purchased a full burqa. And I wear it. So, and in different contexts, because I work in Lancashire, as you can tell, and I work with some Asian people, and I work in some very racist white communities as well. And it's not, I haven't concluded the social, the learning, if you like, but it's a good way of, the first gentleman that spoke, it's a really good way when you're behind a veil of actually learning a lot about it. You can talk about it, but then wearing it, I found was really valuable.
Thank you. So sort of walk a mile in my shoes kind of a thing. So you get to know. There were a couple of those, a guy in the green shirt and then a guy in the white stripy shirt.
Thank you. It's just a comment on the prevent agenda. The Home Affairs Select Committee released a report, I think, a couple of weeks ago, which made far-reaching comments about the prevent agenda and various other things linked to the overall area of violent extremism. But it made a number of quite serious recommendations for change, and it has yet to receive a government response, but it's worth being aware that was done.
Thank you. And the Interfaith Network for the UK, which Ashley is with, is a very good source of information and all that kind of stuff, sort of above the radar through their newsletters and also below the radar. Isn't that right? Can't we just have a quiet chat with you guys? I think so.
Further to that, on the same theme, I'm involved as a foster carer, and we all had to have this training in this was local authority. And there were no exceptions, despite the fact that we foster children under a year old, who, of course, might.
Yes. I think vulnerable is the term. At the back.
Yes, sorry, it's a bit loud. I wanted to ask what your thoughts were about the growing sense that I have, certainly living in Birmingham, of the movement about the caliphate, Ummah, and the general non-extremist, but very much integral to a good Muslim's thoughts, feelings about where they live. And perhaps you'd like to explain more to people what that means if people don't understand. But It's something that I think is often left out of conversations because it's not about extremism, but it's very extreme in terms of, potentially very extreme in terms of how people can be drawn away from a kind of sense that they can integrate as Muslims into our communities, how they can feel that they are human beings. I mean, the context of your talk is all about relating to people as individuals who have common goals, common fears, common loves, and so forth. One of my observations is that there are an increasing group of people, particularly perhaps within the cities, who are, as Christians have been encouraged for centuries, to see themselves as different, not to be the same as everyone else. And I think that needs, I'd like to know what you think about that.
I suppose that is a bit about what I was saying at the beginning about if we just stick to the things that we have in common, then we are limited in our relationships. So then when we hit things, and sooner or later that does happen, where we disagree, then our relationship breaks down. So we need to think about how we're approaching this. But the Ummah, I'm a woman, a feminist. I feel a link to women around the world. I care what happens to women around the world. The global Christianity, you know, we are a huge, huge, huge social global network. We don't call it, give it a name like the Muslim Ummah. But we do have those international links, and we do, look at our mission agencies and our mission partners, and so we do keep in touch. I mean, the cathedral in my diocese has links to Zimbabwe, and so on. It's a very active thing to be internationally caring and aware of what's going on and supporting. And so I wouldn't say all Ummah stuff is necessarily a negative thing at all, but so perhaps that's where we kind of need to dig deeper and see, well, what did those particular mean, the people that you're talking about, what do they mean by Ummah, and what is that having a negative effect?
Can I respond to that?
Yes, please.
Because what they mean in those contexts is that they're encouraging each other not to submit themselves to Western authority. They use the term West, the West as a kind of pejorative term, not submit to political authority or other values within our society. And yes, an international feminist movement is a great thing which kind of unites people across the world, but it also has respect for local belonging, local beliefs.
Sometimes, not always.
Yeah, so yes and no. But what we're talking about is the creation of a new world economy,
So I would say that's probably not everyone who talks about the Ummah would be in that group that you're talking about. No. But there are people who are like that. And I think, that comes from, it can come from things that aren't necessarily religious, about being a minority group and feeling a bit on the back foot and wanting to feel a belonging. And so that is a belonging that's on offer. And if the belonging that we are offering is not upfront and out there enough, maybe they don't feel that invitation and don't feel that they do belong here sufficiently. And so that's something that is our responsibility as well as their responsibility. But I think we do need to keep those conversations going, or start them if they're not. It sounds like you are in conversation with people who think like that. Fantastic.
Yeah, I've got a question.
Yes.
It's about worship. I found myself just last week worshipping with some Muslims, Sufi Muslims, who had organized an event at a local old people's home. So we had the elderly residents, this group of Sufi worship group, really. Mm. And it was a lovely occasion, very spiritual, like singing worship songs, really, although the language was a little different. Jesus was mentioned. And, of course, in a way, I spoke to myself and I said, this is parallel worship. We're worshipping together, but perhaps worshipping in parallel, I don't know. But it felt very good, and we shared food afterwards. What about worship together, or is that a no-no? Are there ways in which we can share in worshipping the one God we worship, albeit with our differences?
So many different views on this. Some Christians do believe that we worship the same God. And some Muslims believe that we worship that Muslims and Christians worship the same God, but some Christians don't believe that and don't believe it very strongly, and some Muslims don't believe that either. So if that's the case, then that's not going to work out. I think that's still a work in progress. I'm not sure that it's a must do thing or something that we're kind of aiming at. I want us to be able to be comfortable with difference, like the guy was saying at the back there, so that we don't have to do everything the same and be the same and worship the same God in order to live well together. So
I'm not suggesting that. I'll just add a bit more to my story to make it more interesting. This Muslim community worker friend employed by Near Neighbours was showing me the song "When I Needed a Neighbour, Were You There?" She said, "I like this song. This is great. We must sing this one."
Yes.
And she was saying, why don't we have a Christian, a Muslim, and a Jewish Zika, this sort of worship group moment? So we're working towards something where we have authentic Christian worship with "When I Needed a Neighbor," and another popular one is, I've forgotten the name of it. But, you know, we have worship together, albeit, I think parallel. Is the way to describe it.
And of course, silence. You know, that's the one that many of us use. Just let's have a time of shared silence. And that's a good one. And sometimes that can be. I'm a bit of a one for silence, and an extended long silence of a whole. Any Quakers here? Extended long silence. You know, very powerful. So I don't diss silence, but I think it's only for those who wish to. I would say on the worship front. Were there? Yes, guy right in the middle. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, I won't say too much about this. I just think in order for to actually address your topic here in terms of Christians and Muslims getting together, I think we need to do it honestly and go beyond niceties. And I think the best way about it is sort of like, what are the fundamental differences between us in terms of on a social level, not necessarily on a religious one, and in terms of honour-based violence? Because I don't think anybody really believes that the vast majority of Muslims are into terrorism or support it. However, the majority of them do actually support honour-based violence, which is quite different.
It's a big statement.
Well, no, what I mean is nobody actually actively involved or certainly condoning it. And that's sort of like kind of thing which I think we need to actually talk, you know, and that's where you'll know where people stand. Do you believe people have the right to choose who they want to marry? You know, do you believe, you know, they can change their religion if they want to? They can choose, they can be Muslim and decide, you know, they want to be homosexual. They can come from Islamic home, but they can decide to drink. You know, that kind of thing, you know, what you need to talk, and that's where you know where you stand. Because I don't think sort of like viewing them all as supporting terrorism is going to get in it, but they're sort of like liberal things which we do believe in.
Yes, I agree. And of course, forced marriage, and it's not restricted to Muslim people, Sikhs, Hindus, other people from, particularly from South Asia, are caught up in that. But there are so many people. I would refute what you said, that most Muslims would support that. That's not my experience. But I think we need to work with the Muslims who are challenging that, and the Sikhs, and the Hindus, and the Christians, anybody who's saying that this is a good idea and we just need to keep this, to keep the family together. It's horrific, absolutely horrific what's happening, and we must support those who are standing up against it. But it is very hard. Those two I do, but there are probably lots I don't know. But we're a bit like the AA, the Christian Muslim Forum, that if we don't know, we can find somebody who does. But there are ex Muslims, and who have a support. And lots of churches, sadly, are not that great at accepting those kinds of things as well. So I think we need to look at both sides of this. But yes, yeah, certainly. I mean, let's be in touch. And I'm happy to. Whereabouts are you based? You do, and that's what I've been saying. That's exactly the kind of stuff that the Christian Muslim Forum is talking about, and we would welcome you. I mean, it'd be great if you were part of that, especially with your background. It'd be fantastic. Thank you. Where are we? There's a lady just at the back there, in a seat, and there's a gentleman down here. Oh, sorry, yes, first.
That's okay. Sorry. Just practically looking for a bit of encouragement, really. Very mindful that the leadership of my local mosque is going to be very male-dominated, and the leadership of our church is female. Just kind of wondering what people's experience is of female approach to twin or invite or whatever.
Sometimes, especially during Ramadan, and I have a friend, Cyril, does this, towards the end of Ramadan, where it gets quite intense, it's quite often the women of the Islamic Center who will stay overnight and do the prayers and so on. And it's usually quite, most of the mosques I know have, they're not in the leadership, they're certainly not in the leadership, except exceptionally, but they have quite a strong women's group that meet either in the mosque or somewhere else. And they are known about and accepted, and there's some very feisty, amazing women in these groups. So perhaps that's one way in, to have a woman to woman, to foster those relationships. And that can be a step into the man side of things. It depends a bit what you're trying to do.
If we were to invite our local mosque to our church, the thing is really that it would be a woman inviting the male leadership, and just wondering how that would be accepted by the male leadership.
Try it and see. I wouldn't see that as an automatically a difficult thing at all.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that one of the best learning experiences that I heard about, I didn't actually go on it, was a trip to Jerusalem and Palestine with a group from Leeds, and there were Jews, Christians and Muslims who went together on that trip, and they learned so much about each other, about the city, about having to wait for the Muslims at the airport for 24 hours before they got out. And then going into the different places of worship, and it promoted so much discussion.
And just being by each other's side as people get treated differently is definitely a learning experience, and develops great strong bonds. The Christian Muslim Forum takes Christians and Muslims to Jerusalem and Israel Palestine once a year. And it's the same kind of thing happens, but it's a good thing to. It's expensive, but it's a good thing to do. Was that it? Yes, here, the man with the lanyard.
Let me say something. I'm 80 years old. I come from Harrow. I've lived there all my life, and we've got the most ethnic diversity of any of the London boroughs, I think.
Yes.
When my wife died, I'd got an empty house. What do I do? So I went out to my neighbours and said, come and have a meal. And I was amazed to find I'd got 17 different nations represented. I'd got Hindus, Muslims, Catholic, Protestants, and we had a fantastic meal. I didn't understand the ramifications of they mustn't eat this, they mustn't eat that. But you said, well, we're not allowed to eat. But we're bringing the food that they, we need to eat. It's not about organisations. It's about us going out and meeting people and inviting them in. Sorry.
That's right, so it doesn't feed back.
I know we need organisation, but we seem to want to push it onto organisations to sort these problems out. It's up to us as individuals to go out and say, hey, come and have coffee, come and have tea. Come and have a drink. That's all I want to say. It's not a big thing.
Fantastic, and a tribute to your wife too.
to use your house in that amazing way. So I myself, I would say we need both. We need that human kindness, that sort of gut thing that we must do, and we need structures and organisations in order to do the structural stuff. So both. Is that?
We've got time for one more. There's a gentleman there.
Amongst students, two things that sort of stop Muslim students and non-Muslim students mixing. One is obviously views of sexual relationships and how you go about that and what's acceptable. And the other one is alcohol, because students mix with alcohol in the UK society, and that just excludes mixing with Muslim students. Any thoughts about that?
It's funny, when I must have been about 15, 20 years ago, I got more involved with Muslims and Muslim communities, and it was only then I realised how alcoholic the Church of England really is, and PCC meetings with glasses of wine, and, you know, and it gave me pause for thought as to what that was about. But it is a difficult one, and it's not even just where people are abusing alcohol, but that some Muslim students will just not want to be around where people are drinking alcohol at all. And my student days are a long way past, but it's still a pretty alcohol-fueled lifestyle, I think, for many. I don't know that there's a... I don't know if I've got any particular answers for that. I'll have a think about that and see, because I know anything that can reduce tensions between Muslims, Christians and Jews and others, and atheists, and humanists on campus, I think, is something worthwhile putting a bit of effort into. But I know that generally it's usually at Christian Muslim events you have no alcohol, and that obviously it's very hard for some Christians, but we have to sort of power through that. But you can't really expect students to be quite so generous, maybe. Maybe you can. Maybe you should just push it. Was that the last one?
Let's give Katriana a big thank you.